Job chapter 7, verses 1 to 21 is our reading today. As we race through this middle section of Job, I want to look at chapters 6 and 7 with you today, but I'll not read them all. I'll just take you to 21 verses of Job chapter 7, where Job is responding to what Eliphaz has said to him, one of his friends, and in chapter 7 directs his words to God himself. Does not man have hard service on earth? Are not his days like those of a hired man? Like a slave longing for the evening shadows, or a hired man waiting eagerly for his wages? So I have been allotted months of futility, and nights of misery have been assigned to me. When I lie down, I think, how long before I get up? The night drags on, and I toss till dawn. My body is clothed with worms and scabs. My skin is broken and festering. My days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle, and they come to an end without hope. Remember, O God, that my life is but a breath. My eyes will never see happiness again. The eye that now sees me will see me no longer. You will look for me, but I'll be no more. As a cloud vanishes and is gone, so he who goes down to the grave does not return. He'll never come to his house again. His place will know him no more. Therefore, I will not keep silent. I will speak out in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. Am I the sea or the monster of the deep that you put me under guard? When I think my bed will comfort me and my couch will ease my complaint, even then you frighten me with dreams and terrify me with visions, so that I prefer strangling and death rather than this body of mine. I despise my life. I will not live forever. Let me alone. My days have no meaning. What is man that you make so much of him, that you give him so much attention, that you examine him every morning and test him every moment? Will you never look away from me or let me alone even for an instant? If I have sinned, what have I done to you, O watcher of men? Why have you made me your target? Have I become a burden to you? Why do you not pardon my offenses and forgive my sins? For I shall soon lie down in the dust. You will search for me, but I shall be no more. And you can't miss the pain, can you, or the heartache of a man who's struggling to get his head around why his life is the way it is. And we look to God to speak to us in a moment or two through that word. I'm sure we're well acquainted, most of us, with the incidents that have hit the headlines from time to time of people who have acted in self-defense and then been accused of either assault or of even murder. Perhaps best known in UK was Tony Martin, a farmer in Norfolk in 1999, who found his home being burgled by two men in the middle of the night. He took a shotgun, he killed one of the burglars and seriously wounded the other. He found himself in court, initially convicted of murder, and then that conviction was ultimately replaced with a charge of manslaughter. It was a case that raised all kinds of question marks throughout our kingdom in terms of when is self-defense just that, self-defense, and when it has become an attack that can be criminalized instead. That theme of attack and defense goes through the sporting world. As players are often told that the best form of defense is attack, although Liverpool might not be feeling that way this morning, but that's how the games go. Sometimes we ask ourselves when we defend ourselves verbally, when we think we're under attack and we defend ourselves, has that defense gone too far? When we come to these chapters of Job, Job has clearly felt under attack. Not in terms of his sorrow and pain and sickness and all that's been happening to him, but in terms of what Eliphaz, his friend, has just said in the previous two chapters that we looked at last week. And we sense in chapter 6 and 7 that what Job is doing is simply defending himself against this verbal attack he's got from one of his best and oldest friends. But in a sense, what we're going to look at today together is, did Job go too far? And if he did, why did he do it? And not just as a kind of academic exercise. Each one of us goes through parallel kinds of situation in life. People make suggestions as to why we're suffering or why our business has collapsed. Or some friendly person tells you, you ought to practice what you preach. The sort of thing that Eliphaz had been saying to Job. And when we retort with what we think is nice, balanced self-defense, maybe we've gone over the top sometimes. And we're left with the same kind of questions with which Job finished these two chapters. Before we get into it, let me again remind our hearts of his circumstances. He has suffered enormous grief and total material loss. He is currently experiencing enormous pain and weakness, and he describes that in the verses of chapter 6 in particular. We know, because we've had that little aside at the beginning of the book, that Satan is doing everything he possibly can to shatter Job's trust and faith in God. This is not a static situation where Job is simply experiencing tough times in life. God's taken the curtain back and said, actually, in the spiritual domain, God has given Satan the opportunity to test Job to the limit. Satan says, you know what, God? Job only loves you because you're good to him. Take away all those good things and Job will give up on you. God says, no. Take away all the good things in Job's life and Job will still love me because I'm his God, not because I'm good to him. An enormous challenge that Satan revels in. And so all that happens in these chapters is part of Satan's onslaught against Job to try and break this man in the area of his faith and trust. We're not able to say that's always the case for all of us in our own struggles and trials in life, but it's something we need to take as a possibility that when bad things happen to good people, it's that same kind of attempt by Satan to shake the very core of our faith. Will this person still hold on to God even when all the circumstances of life have gone wrong for them? The icing on top of the cake of suffering for Job was when his friends had come and sat with him for a week in silence, but then decided to speak. And in chapters 4 and 5, we saw how Eliphaz responded to Job. Job, you ought to practice what you preached. You helped other people. Come on, start applying it to yourself. As though he wasn't. Job, you're reaping what you've sown. No matter what you protest about your innocence, God's a just God, and if he's giving you a hard time, it's because you sowed bad stuff and are reaping bad stuff as a result. Suggestion number 3, Job, you should have expected trouble. Man is born to trouble like the sparks fly upwards, and instead of thinking you've got a cozy way of life ahead, Job, you should have jolly well expected things to be tough. Why didn't you? And lastly, Job, God's correcting you. He'll bless you enormously if you just come to the point where you say, yeah, God, I messed up, I failed you, I've been bad, and I'm sorry for it. So as we end Eliphaz's retort to him, Job's handling that. And it's his self-defense in these two chapters we're looking at. In chapter 6, in a sense, he defends himself against Eliphaz, the person who's just spoken. And then in chapter 7, he's defending himself by talking to God. And the two chapters, 6 and 7, are well divided. Chapter 6, mostly addressed to Eliphaz. Chapter 7, mostly addressed to God himself. Again, worth keeping in mind through these chapters, they are poetic. Depending on the version or translation you have, they might be set out in italics or lighter form of print. Just to make the point, they are poetic. They're not his theological statements. They express how he feels in the situation as he defends himself. So first of all, Job's issues with Eliphaz, and I'll take you through them quite quickly. Chapter 6 and verse 3, he basically saying to Eliphaz, you don't feel how heavy my burden is. If only my anguish could be weighed, this is chapter 6 and verse 2, if only my anguish could be weighed and all my misery be placed on the scales, it would surely outweigh the sand of the seas. No wonder my words have been impetuous. I think that's lovely. He's accepting some of what Eliphaz has said is right. He has spoken in haste. He's spoken impetuously in his earlier words. But he's saying, Eliphaz, you haven't interpreted my pain. That's what we were saying about Eliphaz last week. Eliphaz was very cold, very logical, very sensible, very theologically correct. But Eliphaz had failed Job at not feeling what Job was feeling. He hadn't tried to. And that's the first self-defense that Job offers to Eliphaz here in chapter 6. Eliphaz, you haven't tried to feel what this is like for me. As we said last week, it's incumbent on all of us when we try to be alongside one another in the pains and sufferings of life, not to blurt out all the nice cliches of the day, not to come off with all the profound theological truths, even though they're important, but actually to make sure that we've shown we felt the pain that others have felt. So Job says, Eliphaz, get the scales out. Weigh up what I've been coming through before you start blurting off all you think about me. Second thing he says to Eliphaz is, you don't understand my innocence, verse 10. Remember, one of the issues with Eliphaz's comments on Job was, Job, you've gone to God and told him you're innocent. How can anyone do that? We reap what we sow, and if you've got bad stuff, you sow bad stuff. There's some truth in all that. But Job is right in saying to Eliphaz, you haven't understood what I mean by my innocence. Job isn't saying he's a pure, holy, non-sinning person. What he's saying, and it's in chapter 6 and verse 10 there, is God's fired all his arrows at me, but I've never spoken or acted against God and his word. Although Job hasn't been aware of it, there's that battle going on between God and Satan. And Job is actually saying, you know what? There's no difference in my life now and relationship to God than what it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago when God was blessing me. He's saying your argument that I'm reaping what I sow, that God's chastising me or God's disciplining me or God's punishing me, doesn't fit because I'm still in the same relationship with God as I was previously. And even in the darkest night of my suffering, I have not spoken a word against God himself. And Eliphaz hasn't got that. That's part of Job's self-defense. The third thing he says to Eliphaz in chapter 6 is, Eliphaz, you haven't acted like true friends. And it's quite a long section in chapter 6 that starts with verses 11 to 13, where he describes his own weakness and lack of strength. The arrows, if I start reading verse 4, the arrows of the Almighty are in me. My spirit drinks in their poison. God's terrors are marshaled against me. Does a wild donkey bray when it has grass, or an ox bellow when it has fodder? And what he's saying is, you know, if I had the strength to cope, I would have coped differently. But I don't have that strength. So he's saying, what I actually needed when I was as weak as that was friends who would help me. And you're on down in chapter 6 to verse 14. A despairing man should have the devotion of his friends, even though he forsakes the fear of the Almighty. And I thought, well, we're stopping this morning and taking that in. It's a powerful phrase. I don't think there's a parallel to it anywhere else in Scripture. What Job, in self-defense, is saying to Eliphaz is, a man's friend should stick with him whatever the circumstances are through which they're going, and act as friends to him, not as judge and jury to him. And the illustration he uses, which is absolutely phenomenal, is even if that friend has forsaken God the Almighty, his friend should still stay with him. Isn't that powerful? Because very often in the Christian life, when someone close to us as a Christian departs from their faith, or behaviorally messes up, or in words speaks something that we feel is way off beam, our instant reaction is, well, you know, I'll put distance between me and him. I'll make sure they don't have her around for coffee for the next month or two. Look how bad they've got. Look how far they've wandered. Look how low they've fallen. And Job is saying to Eliphaz, Eliphaz, even if it was true that I'd spoken against God, that I'd failed God, that I'd sinned against God, that I'd turned my back against God, surely a friend is someone who sticks with you in that experience. Not someone who writes you off because you don't quite fit the circle of friends any longer. Quite challenging that, quite good. Verses 15 to 20, he says, my friends are like a river. And here's very graphic language. And if you've watched the pictures of swollen rivers in drought-torn eastern England in the past week or two, you'll understand the metaphor. He says, you're like rivers, which when there's loads of rain, you're overflowing your banks. But when there's a scarcity of water, I go to the river and find it's dried up. We don't quite have that state here in the country now, but I remember being in Peru with Desi Creelman and John Brute Setter driving up dried up riverbeds. It wasn't the rainy season. They could drive their Jeep right up through them knowing there wasn't a drop of water to be found anywhere. And that's the picture that Job's using here. He says, friends ought to be rivers which, when you're thirsty, will give you something to drink. But he said, you're like rivers which have loads when there's other water available, and you've absolutely nothing to offer when things are really tough. Fair weather friends is his accusation against Eliphaz. I think he's probably a bit over the top. I think his self-defense is becoming a bit of an attack, isn't it? He's being a bit harsh, because we saw right at the beginning when these friends arrive, they travel miles to be with him. They've given up their businesses for this period of time. They've left their families for a good while. They've traveled and sat with him on the rubbish heap outside the city for 7 days, not eating or drinking, in absolute silence to show their solidarity with him. So we're a bit rough now to say you're like dried up riverbeds that don't have anything to offer when times are tough. But of course, sometimes when we are stressed, when we are under great pressure, we do say things that are over the top. We do get carried away with the emotion of the moment. We do turn our self-defense into attack. And it's a good reminder to all of us, when we do suffer, to try and put that guard on our lips and our thoughts. That when someone says things to us that aren't right, that instead of jumping in and defending to the point of attack, we take it more calmly than that. Not easy to do, as Job is discovering. The fourth way in which he responds to Eliphaz is in verse 21 of chapter 6, saying, "You have responded in fear rather than in truth." Again, a very interesting phrase. Verse 21. "Now you've proved to be no help to me. You see something dreadful and are afraid." Isn't that interesting? We'd expect Job to be fearful. He's the one who's suffering. He's the one who has lost all his family members except his wife. He's the one whose whole livestock has been wiped out or stolen. He's the one whose body is so painful his friends hardly recognized him when they arrived to see him. We can understand Job being frightened. But Job has just listened to one of his oldest and best friends, Eliphaz, try to correct him. And says, "You know what, Eliphaz, I think you've spoken in fear at this whole situation rather than in calm common sense." And I guess he's right. Because sometimes when we see others suffering and don't know how to help them, we feel not just lost for words, but scared about the impact both on that person and on ourselves of what they're going through. The reason Job makes something out of this is because he needs his friends not to speak out of fear, but rather to speak in truth. Integrity for Job was a key issue. Job is under test by Satan, though he doesn't know it, to say something untrue against God or about God. Job is struggling in his painful situation to maintain his integrity with God. "I have not denied the words of the Holy One," verse 10. He needs his friends to be faithful to the truth of the situation. I guess if we'd asked Eliphaz and his friends after this all happened, "You know, why did you guys say the things you said?" Someone might say, "Well, you know, we're just being honest to our views and our opinions. We're just being honest the way we felt." And that was true. But they weren't actually being honest to the truth of the situation. They were guessing why Job was suffering. We know that it didn't cross their minds for one single moment, nor Job's either, all the way through this book, what actually lay behind the situation. They didn't know it. God hadn't shown it to them. What his friends do, and we've all been there, is use a bit of guesswork. "Well, Job, I think that what's happening is you must have sinned and God's punishing you." Or, "Job, I think you've done some bad stuff and you're reaping what you sowed." Or whatever. But they had held that up. Eliphaz had held that up as being the truth. And remember the end of chapter 5, he actually says, "You know, we've had a wee discussion about this, and this is exactly how it is, Job. This is a fact." And what Job is now saying is, "Eliphaz, you guys have not been good friends to me by representing as truth what was actually just your guesswork in the situation." Again, I think that's an important lesson for us to try and cope with ourselves. All of us, I guess, been in a situation where a suffering friend has asked us, "Can you tell me why this is happening to me?" And there's something inside of us that just cannot bring ourselves to say, "I don't know." We feel this suffering friend has this huge expectation that they're putting on us to give them an answer, to tell them the reason, to provide the solution. And if we turn back to them and say, "Well, you know, I'm a bit puzzled, just like you are," we feel that's a bit lame. That's not very helpful to them. We feel that sharing their puzzlement isn't a very kind way of leaving them on a difficult day for them. But actually, I think Job is right as he defends himself to Eliphaz here and says, you know what, guessing the reason and then calling out the truth is far more hurtful. Far better for us as God's people to say to someone who's going through a tough time, I actually don't know why this is happening. I don't have a reason. I can give you kind of guesses, but that's the best as far as I can go. That's far more helpful than saying, you know what, brother? I'll tell you why. If you don't really know the answer at all. So that's his defense to Eliphaz face to face. It's strong, it's powerful, it's angry, it's maybe a bit over the top, but we understand why. Quick flick into chapter 7 as we look at Job's dilemma with God. He begins his talk with God by describing what life feels like to him now. And I guess that you all had, if you understood the words, some kind of sense of, yeah, I've been there, done that. He says, it's like being a slave who, working through the heat of the day, you just think, oh, if only I could get to the cool of the evening, if only I could get my wages and clear off, I'd be as happy as Larry. Or he says, I feel like being awake during the middle of the night saying, oh, when is the morning going to come? Because things seem so unbearable at that point in time. Part of his life feels it lasts forever, like the night that never ends. And yet part of his life feels like, the words of verse 6, as though it's passing swifter than a weaver's shuttle. Have you ever seen a weaver where that shuttle flies across in the blink of an eye? And it says, on one side, the days seem long and unbearable, the nights seem long and unbearable, and yet when I sum up my whole life, God, it's flying past so quick, I can't get a hold of it, I can't stop the train. In a language quite like that of the writer of Ecclesiastes, he reckons that the life that drags out so slowly in one sense, yet passes so quickly in another, will actually leave him forgotten, and his life will seem to have been pointless. If you look at verses 8 to 10 of chapter 7, you just see how painful and powerful that word to God is. And after saying all this about the way that life seems to him just now, then Job explains to God why he, Job, must prolong this conversation with God. Eliphaz has basically said, Job, you better keep quiet. Don't go to God and start emptying your stomach to God because you're going to say bad things to him. His friends have told him to stop arguing with God and stop arguing with God's discipline and punishment. But if you look at verse 11, you find one of the biggest therefores, I think, in the whole of the Bible. Therefore, I will not keep silent. I'll speak out of the anguish of my spirit. What's going on in Job's head as he talks to God? He's seeing the sweetness of life like it used to be. Then he's seeing the emptiness, pain, and pointlessness of life as it now seems to be. And he just can't reconcile those two utterly different experiences. He hasn't changed. As far as he can see, looking inside his own soul, he's the same man now in the pointlessness and painfulness of life as Job was when he was enjoying all the good things in life and one of the best men on earth in God's estimation. So he sees himself being the same man, but circumstances totally different. He believes that God is the same God now as he always was. He doesn't believe God's changed or that God's moved the goalposts. The same God who blessed him with family and friends and finances and farms and all the good stuff he had in the past, and the God who looked down from heaven and said, this is the best, most spiritual, godly man on earth, the God's still the same. And so as Job responds to God and tries to engage with God, here's this great battle that's going on in his mind. And he said, because that battle's there, God, I can't stay silent. I can't be quiet. I need to work this out with you, Lord. Probably there was a time in Job's life when he'd have argued exactly the same way as Eliphaz would have done. But now he's in a total dilemma as he keeps asking, why? Not just, why am I suffering? Or why am I sad? Or why am I in crisis? But how can I reconcile these two different lives when, as far as I feel, I haven't changed a bit for the worse? If you had been born in Northern Ireland, I reckon you'd be saying to God, God, this is doing my head in. Because there's this raging conflict in his head that he just couldn't settle. I don't know if you have noticed the current performance being advertised on the outside of the Opera House, the Hole in the Wall gang performing Give My Headpiece. And if I was able to go incognito into the Opera House for the next wee while, I might pop in to enjoy some of their humour. On the other hand, I'd probably be spotted and reprimanded and maybe put out of office for going to such a show. But Give My Headpiece is actually quite a good Ulster phrase. And sometimes the real problem in suffering is not the pain itself. Is not the loss, however great that's been, not the sadness that eats our souls. It's the headache. It's that confusion that spins round and round in our heads. Why is God doing this? Or why has God arranged this way, or why has God permitted this to happen? And whatever verb we put in there, the same ultimate question batters our minds. I've tried to be exactly the same person spiritually all the way through my life. If anything, I've tried to improve and deepen my relationship with God from one stage to the next. So why is this happening to me? We're not unique then. We share Job's pain. If in the midst of our dark times we cry out, give my head peace, Lord. And just allow some kind of solution to creep in that answers the why question. For Job, that resolution, that peace, didn't come through the wordy explanations of Eliphaz and his friends. They didn't give a proper answer to the why. In fact, as you go through the whole book, Job never found peace through carefully worded argument. Peace would come to Job as he trusted God for what he could not see and could not understand. At the end of the book, and I don't want to run too far ahead of me, but just to give a little thought to keep me going through these dark chapters, at the end of the day, Job would simply say, God, you're such a great God, I can trust you. Didn't have the answer to the why question, but got the peace to trust. And that's what counted. One of the great calls of this book is a call to implicitly trust God just because he is God. To reckon that God can be trusted even when he doesn't give us an explanation of the why question. To get our heads peace. It's not about going to the Opera House and listening to the Hole in the Wall gang. Giving our heads peace is saying, God, I cannot fathom this. I cannot understand it. I cannot see it. But I utterly trust you. I depend upon you. I believe that you know what you're doing. And I rest myself in you. That's how to find peace, like a river attending our ways.